Welcome to episode 16 of the Choose FI radio podcast. Today we have Coach Carson stopping by to teach us a new skill, how to hack your housing, live for free, and start investing in real estate today. This is a tool that you can use to supercharge your path to FI, and it's one of these unconventional choices that we talk about that radically changes the math. So definitely check this one out. Welcome to the show, guys.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
As I mentioned earlier, there's certain things that you can do that possibly you'd never considered that can so radically transform the equation that you absolutely have to just take a step back and look at it and see if maybe it's realistic for your life or for your family or for your kids. And there's no one better to help coach us through this process than the one and only Coach Carson. Hi, Coach. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
I think yesterday you just released an article on hacking your housing. I think it's one that you've been teasing is coming for a while. And we're very excited to finally get access to it. And today we just want to take some time and actually talk about what that actually looks like. So real estate, there's several different ways that you can get to financial independence. If you make a great income, then you could probably just focus on tax optimization and savings rate. But that's not always an option for everybody, but everybody can get started in real estate in some shape or form. And so the next question is, how do you do it without screwing yourself over financially? Because if there's a safe, predictable way to do it, where it's a realistic amount of risk to return, then at some point it becomes to look like something that everybody should consider. And I think that what you're putting together, Chad, is that model. You are modeling it for people. And I think that there's going to be a lot of value to what we're going to talk about today.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciate you guys mentioning that. And I think one of the things about housing, you know, you mentioned that everybody kind of touches real estate. And it's one of those unique things that, you know, everybody lives in a house, right? So there's a few people who live out in a tent somewhere, but pretty much everybody lives in a house. And so if you're in that case, you're going to be at least having the potential to consider real estate and how does it affect your bottom line. And really when it comes, you guys talk a lot about budget and you're trying to cut your expenses. And one of the things that first struck me when I first started investing in real estate was if you look at your monthly budget, how much of that is going to housing? How much of your budget is being going out the door? Yeah. Whether that's rent, whether that's a mortgage, whether that's maintenance on a house. And so if you can figure out a way to get that right, even if you don't even, if you don't have to buy a big apartment buildings or do any of that, a lot of my focus on the very first step with real estate is, hey, let's look at your own housing situation and just not be stupid with that, or at least be super smart with it and really hack it and figure out a way to even make money on your housing. If you can do that, you just totally flip the entire equation of kind of retiring early, of achieving financial independence, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. So I think probably to be fair to our audience, we really do need to introduce you. I would love to just hop right into the content just because you did such a great, you know, introduction and telling your story on the Mad Scientist. But just for the sake of catching our audience up and giving them something to point to, tell us a little bit, just a little bit about your story and how you got where you are and where you are, because you're not currently in the United States, although you have 90 rental units.
Yeah. So my story in brief is I graduated from college. I was actually a football player in college in Clemson, South Carolina. So anybody who follows college football, you know, they won the national championship last year. Go Tigers.
Congrats.
So I live in a little college town and the same place I went to school. And 15 years ago, I started the traditional route. I was a biology major, kind of pre-med route. I just decided to become an entrepreneur from the very beginning. Didn't have much to lose at that point. And I owned my Toyota Camry free and clear. So I was willing to live in that if I had to. And we just, with a business partner, the two of us started figuring out how to find good deals on real estate, buy and sell. So we bought and sold a lot of houses, fixed them up eventually. And then we started buying some rental properties and keeping those and, you know, kind of through some ups and downs, we kind of grew into the 2007, 2008 downturn and kind of made it through that. Now, that's a whole nother story. Maybe we can do a podcast on that one. But, you know, the end result, though, for me is that real estate's been my engine for not only for making a living, you know, that's how I put food on the table, but then also parallel to that, I used it to build wealth. And I think that's the most relevant thing for everybody. There's a few people who kind of go into real estate and flip houses and do that full time, but there's a big broad range of people who can benefit from even, you know, just owning one rental property or owning a couple rental properties, flipping a house here and there. And so that's really where my passion is for helping people is, you know, how do you figure out how to do that one, that first deal, that one deal that can kind of get you over the edge? Or, you know, if you can just own one or two properties free and clear, that can produce 1,000 or 2 a month, which puts a lot of people in a much better position financially. And so that's kind of my story in a nutshell. But you mentioned that in the end, living off rental income was always our goal. And we built our own little management business. And I have a really awesome person back in Clemson right now who helps me out. I have a business partner back there who helps a lot too. But my family and I moved this year to Ecuador. That's been a big goal for us, is to go abroad. So my wife and I and our two kids are living here for about a year and a half, and immersing ourselves. My wife's a Spanish teacher, so she's already fluent, but I'm going to try to become more fluent. Our kids are learning Spanish, living in another culture. That's just part of our big why of why we're doing all this is to be able to have those kind of experiences.
Yeah, that's so cool, Chad. I mean, we actually last week we had Justin from Root of Good on the podcast, and we talked a lot about, you certainly know Justin, a great blog, and we talk a lot about kids and how financial independence impacts your kids. And I mean, what a cool thing that you and your family were able to pick up, move to Ecuador. I think you told us for a year and a half, and you still have this thriving real estate business going on back in South Carolina, but you guys are living the life and just spending time with each other. I mean, that to me is the perfect way to describe financial independence.
It's we love it. We kind of pinch ourselves when we wake up. My wife and I were eating breakfast this morning and saying, I can't believe we're doing this. This is really amazing. So it's a lot of fun. And I hope this story can inspire other people too, though. And I have to, maybe we can link to this in the show notes, but I wrote an article about how difficult it is to detach yourself from your existing life. And we spent basically a whole year last year. We feel like we're fairly frugal people. You know, we don't buy tons of stuff. We don't have a new piece of furniture in our house, but it was an enormous, like, pulling your wisdom teeth kind of detachment to try to pull yourself out of a situation. And some of it was good. You know, you're contributing to a community, you're here and there. But I think that part of it in itself, people who are considering traveling, even if you're not a big traveler, forcing yourself out of your normal situation just to kind of get rid of stuff and get rid of attachments was a big exercise for us.
Yeah, that's really cool. And we will have everything linked up in the show notes, and that's at choosefi.com/016. So Chad, I mean, did you guys literally sell everything you own? I mean, did you get rid of your house or wherever you were living? I mean, talk us through that real quick. I'm just so interested in this.
Yeah, no, we rented our house. That's another benefit of being a real estate person is that, you know, when you have an asset like that, you're like, I'm going to use the asset. And selling houses is great at times, and I think as a tool, but we kept it and we rented our house out for a couple of years. And our main plan is to go back to the house after we're done. So we have a cool couple in there who are living there for 2 years, and then we will see how it goes. So that gives us a big window, though, to be flexible in the interim. And we did, but my wife spent tons of time selling yard sale stuff and all the kids stuff, baby stuff, and you know all this stuff. You can't believe how much just junk accumulates in the basement. Yes. We did a lot of that kind of cleaning. And I was just surprised how many connections you have, both good and bad, with just non-material stuff, just meetings and clubs you're in. And I helped start a nonprofit 2 years ago that's trying to make greenway trails in our hometown, and how involved I was in that. And you just don't realize until you step back and leave how busy your life is. And so you get, I mean, Latin America is perfect. I love the Spanish culture of siestas and taking it easy, and hey, you gringo Americans are working too hard, and you know, it's just, and they do work hard here, but it's like more, hey, your family on Sundays, you hang out, you go to the plaza and you walk around, and it's for a hardworking A type like me, this is like a perfect situation to say, chill out, dude, you know, take it easy.
You're getting younger every day.
That's so awesome.
Exactly. Yep.
Hey, Chad, going back to the beginning of your story. So one thing that struck me, and even as you described it here, is your old Toyota Camry and cutting down life expenses to do what you wanted to do, right? Which is build this business and have some ability to do that without this huge overhead. And you know, one thing that struck me was, I think you lived in your business partner's like spare bedroom with boxes littered around. Like, can you, that was just such a cool story. I'd love to just hear it super quick about that and like, and how that helped you. And like, and the thought process that went into that, as opposed to, oh, hey, I'm a, you know, football player who was hugely successful in college and I deserve this, right? Like everybody else thinks. Like, what made you think differently?
Yeah, I think that'll be a good segue into house hacking too, because, you know, when I first started, it was just by necessity. It's like, all right, I'm not producing any income here. I have no guaranteed salary. And I think a lot of college students, when you leave, you feel like that compulsion to say, you know, particularly because you have debt. And I didn't have any debt because I got a scholarship to play football in college. So that's kind of an aside that I was very fortunate in that situation. But the fact that, you know, I said, I have to be super lean here to be an entrepreneur. I think those two things go hand in hand. That to be an entrepreneur is you're taking a risk. You're not guaranteed of success. And, you know, going for financial independence is very similar to being an entrepreneur. You know, there's no guarantees in life. You have to take some risks here. At the same time, entrepreneurs are also very risk averse, which is very ironic. So, you know, I knew I was taking a risk. I knew there was no guarantee I was going to make money next month. I always had to hustle, hustle, hustle. But the thing you can control is how much is going out the door. And I knew that. I just had a kind of an intuition for that for whatever reason. And so my business partner and I just talked about it. Hey, we're going to start business. I'm going to move back to Clemson. And I started thinking housing is always the first thing you think about because that's such a big part of your budget. He had a spare bedroom, I noticed, and there was just a bunch of boxes stacked up. And I didn't even realize there was a bed until I moved some of the boxes. And there's just like this old single bed that had like springs sticking out of it and stuff, you know. And so I said, hey, can I sleep on that bed for the first, you know, few months of while we're starting this business? He's like, I don't care. You can whatever. Yeah, clean it up. And so that worked out. And I think it lasted about 10 or 11 months until we finally flipped a couple houses and I had a little bit of money and I decided to kind of venture off. But house hacking was the next, you know, it was soon after that. It wasn't right after that was the next step because I liked that not having a housing payment. That was a pretty cool thing.
It does feel like a little bit of a hack, doesn't it? Oh, housing is no longer an issue.
Yeah. You take away housing. And once you get rid of your housing bill, it's kind of hard to go back. You know, you're like, really? I got to pay for housing? That's, you know, my wife and I finally moved into a real house. We were going to start a family. And we're like, oh, we can't live in this 2-bedroom, 1-bath apartment anymore. It's kind of cramped. We said, we'll move up to a 1500 square foot house. We're just going to go all out and get a mansion. You know? And so when we had like a $400 a month payment, we were, this is crazy. What are we doing? You know, we were living positive 100 a month before that. So I'm just warning everybody when you learn about this, it kind of ruins you for the normal life.
All right, Chad, well, why don't you just go ahead and hop right in and tell us what is house hacking?
Okay. So, you know, house hacking, first of all, for people who are a little bit skeptical about it, I'm not like a scammer or somebody who like into like hacking what the White House or something. What house hacking means basically is you're living in a small multi-unit property typically. So instead of getting the biggest single family house on the block, you're going to look for like a duplex, a triplex, a quadruplex in a perfect world. You live in one unit, you rent out the other units, and by getting the rent from those other units, you can use that to pay your housing bill. And so that's really, if you just want to simplify the whole concept, that is the concept of house hacking. You're finding some way to generate income from your residence instead of just living there and having all the money go out the door. And so that from that simple concept, and we can get into some of the kind of like the different variations of it. There's a lot of creativity you can get into. And it of course depends on where you live, on what kind of product. You know, maybe your city doesn't have a lot of quadruplexes. Maybe it has duplexes. Maybe, you know, people who live out in the country, I've known people who live in a house that's on a 2-acre plot and they put three mobile homes on the second lot next door and get like a little retiree mobile home community to pay for their housing. So there's all sorts of ways to make it work. But I think the idea that everybody wants to get in their head is that particularly early in your career, you know, I'm not asking if you're 60 years old and you want to do a house hack, I'd say more power to you. I would do it too. But particularly when you're in your 20s and 30s, my mission is to make sure people know that how big of a deal it is to go 10 years living in a house with a $1,000 housing payment instead of doing a house hack and cutting that in half or taking it all the way to zero. You know, you guys talk about compounded math and the future value of money all the time. I mean, I challenge all the listeners to take away your housing payment, put that in a future value calculator, figure out what that means for you 10, 20 years down the road. And that'll, even if you weren't that motivated before, I think that'll start kind of getting you more interested in the concept.
I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here, but you start putting an extra $1,000 a month aside from the age of 20 because you just implemented this one hack, and then you never are paying for rent or mortgage again because of this one choice. You are, that's a huge head start.
Big time. Yeah. It's, I mean, it, I wrote an article on, it was one of my first articles I got on Rockstar Finance. I was so pumped. It was about how to become rich by living in ugly houses and using embarrassing old cars. Yeah. And I basically talked about that concept where you said, you know, the future value of this kind of thing is $700,000 or $1 million 20, 30 years from now. I mean, it's a really big deal.
Wow. Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. That sounds awesome.
And Chad, that's one of my favorite titles of an article, by the way. I absolutely love it. And I mean, it's so crucial, not spending money on the major legs of most people's budgets are a brand new car payment or, God forbid, a lease, an expensive house, right, that they have to keep up with the Joneses. And then we talk about food being a third major part of people's budgets. Mm-hmm. And we've talked in prior podcasts about how to save on food. But man, if you can cut between one and three of those things down significantly, I mean, those are the life hacks that you need to go from a regular middle class keeping up with the Joneses to someone who can be financially independent in 5, 10, 15 years, whatever it may be. So yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
And I think that's something interesting, guys, is that, you know, so much of the financial world seems to be so complicated to people. And one of the messages I try to convey out there is that it doesn't have to be that complicated. It's definitely not easy, but I mean, a house hack is not easy. You're going to have to, there's some objections people have. I've got to live next door to tenants. You know, how awful is that? And I have to, you know, I have to do this or that. But the fact is, if you can do a few simple things like you're talking about, you can hack your food, you can hack your housing, you can not have any car debt, you can use travel rewards to not have to pay for vacations once or twice a year. You really don't have to do that much smart, fancy stuff if you do those three or four things. I mean, it's, and in particular with real estate, you know, one of the things that I did early on was I tried to get too complicated, too fancy with it. When in reality, some of the best mentors I've had in real estate have said, you know what, just keep it simple. You know, buy a house a year for 5 years and make each deal better than the next one. You know, don't try to be fancy. Don't try to be crazy. And I think that applies to everything in your life. I think just keep it super simple. Try to do the fundamentals really, really well. That's like one of my old football things. You know, every day you went to football practice, all you did for the first 20 minutes of practice was do these little basic little footwork drills. And, you know, how do you move your hands, move your arms and get low? And so I think in finances, we needed to do the same thing. Don't try to get fancy with it. Just be simple. Find the strategies that really resonate with you, that don't seem that complicated, and that seem like they're a little bit easier to apply. Because if they're super fancy, and you have to talk to a person up in Wall Street who can explain this 150-page contract on how to become financially independent, you know, that's not for me. That's you know, maybe somebody likes that, but I think the kind of people who are listening to this show are your do-it-yourself or at least take control of your own destiny kind of people. And to me, that the route to doing that is to keep it simple, to go with something you understand, which for me is real estate.
Yeah, Chad, I totally agree with that simplicity, and that's like my guiding light in life is keeping everything simple, trying to lower stress while still being open-minded. I'm not closed-minded to anything, but
sure.
But I know that if my guiding light is simplicity, then I'm going to do okay down the road. So yeah, totally, totally hear you with that. I have one question just before we get started in, you know, the nuts and bolts of house hacking. And just as an aside to everyone, we are going to have a link to this article in the show notes. And also, I highly advise everyone to sign up for Chad's email list. He has a really great email series. I'm looking to get started in real estate and I'm learning a ton from him. So yeah, that's just a little plug for his email series, which is phenomenal.
Thank you.
But yeah, you got
it. I appreciate that.
And on the same line, his toolkit, I can't believe some of the stuff that you're giving away for free on that. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. It's Coach Carson is just a great site. So my question just right off the bat is, okay, how do you find one of these duplex, triplex, fourplex? How does someone even start? For me, at least with real estate, it's the mental hurdle of, wow, I have no idea how to even start or know if I'm getting a good deal, or how would I find a fourplex? I have no idea.
Right. That's a really good question. I think the difficult part mentally and also practically is finding that deal. And so I think my recommendation, that was the first skill I learned when I first started investing in real estate. I was a bird dog for other people who actually had money, because I had no money. And so I went out and just kind of snipped around. A bird dog, for those who don't know, I'm from the South, and you know, people like to go out in the country and hunt for birds and that kind of thing. So a bird dog is like somebody who points, you know, to the deal, or you know, a bird would point to the birds in the bush and the hunter would shoot the birds and take them home for dinner. And so what you do as a bird, you know, as a bird dog, I would learn to kind of go out and find those deals for other people. But the skill set I learned was that there's really two parts of that equation. One part, luckily for everybody, you don't really need to learn. Like the part of real estate that's really important is the qualitative part. Like what does it mean to be in a good neighborhood? What does it mean to be in a good house? And I think if you've ever hunted for houses as a rental property, like if you just wanted to go live somewhere and you're looking for a rental, if you ever look for a house to buy, you sort of know the qualities that make good real estate. And so those things are, you know, it depends on the location, of course, but you know, if you're in a kind of a big urban area, you're going to look for the neighborhoods that have a little bit of charm, that have the big trees, that have sidewalks that are walkable, that have public transportation nearby, but they're not too busy, they're safe. And so just like think of those little checklists that you would put just for a place to live yourself. And if you're totally a dunce, you know, if you're the numbers person, the numbers, and then your spouse or your partner or somebody else is like the person who recognizes like good quality kind of stuff, you know, go with your spouse, let them choose the neighborhood first. And you want to start with that. So I'm saying all that. And I had a teacher in real estate who used to say you wanted to look for like romance in a city. You wanted to look for something that kind of drew you in and that had an emotional appeal. And so that's completely opposite of all the numbers that we'll get into next, but it's really important because all of the numbers in real estate are derived from the emotional decision that people have to either rent a place or to buy a house. I mean, it all starts from that. All the money you make in real estate comes to you because you deliver a product that has emotional appeal. Because living in a home is emotional. You know, that's where you raise your family. That's where you know, that's kind of when you get home from work. That's where you go to kind of, you know, get away from everything else. So if you start with that and whatever it means in your city, that's where you go. You want to go hunting in neighborhoods and you want to ignore the neighborhoods that don't have the romance. And so for me, like the new kind of cookie cutter neighborhoods on the edge of town that are kind of on, you have to drive on an interstate to get there and there's nothing appealing about it at all. Yeah. There's something not as good a quality about that kind of real estate. And so I like the infill neighborhoods, the places where it's already been good for 30, 40 years and it's kind of getting better and better. And I read a study one time that Starbucks, if you follow Starbucks, they do some kind of really complicated research, but you know, there's a trend that anytime Starbucks goes into a neighborhood, it typically goes up in value, and it's a good. And so there's little hacks like that you can figure out. But once you go to those neighborhoods, the question is how do you even find a good deal? And you know, I would recommend, particularly if you're brand new, to actually hiring an agent to help you out with that. You know, I do have my real estate license. It's something I don't think everybody has to do, especially early on. But if you find a good agent and you tell them some of those neighborhoods that you're looking for, then they can run a very, very simple search for you and say, I want to find duplexes, triplexes, and quadruplexes in these five neighborhoods. And there might be, let's just say there's 20 listed properties in those neighborhoods. Then you could just go on your own on the weekends and go kind of ride by those, take a look at them. Even better, get out of the car and walk around and look at them. And so that's my favorite way to do it, is just to walk the neighborhoods and actually look at stuff. And then a real estate agent, or you know, you can use Zillow, you can use some of these other ones too, that are pretty good search engines online. But the first step, of course, kind of going back, is choosing neighborhoods and then doing some kind of online search to kind of get a working list of what's out there, what kind of inventory is out there, and then just go explore around and start, you know, walking around neighborhoods, actually talking to neighbors. You know, if you get out from behind your computer in real estate and actually get in a neighborhood. And if you're walking, you know, with your, you know, if you have a daughter or a son and kids, you know, push the stroller, because you're going to be able to talk to a lot more people that way. You're not as intimidating. And just ask people, you know, I'm looking for a duplex in the neighborhood. I really love this area. Do you know anybody who's looking to sell? Do you have any ideas of houses that are available or duplexes that are available? And if you go out for 5 hours on a Saturday and make it a goal to talk to 10 people in a neighborhood, you will learn an incredible amount. You'll probably get 4 or 5 leads on some deals. You'll probably look at 4 or 5 vacant houses that you didn't even realize were vacant until you started walking the neighborhood. And that could probably keep you busy for 2 weeks of just kind of finding, kind of following up on those leads, seeing, you know, calling signs and that sort of thing.
I've heard about the idea of just walking neighborhoods, and I could just never visualize myself actually doing it, going and knocking on a door and saying, hey, do you know anything about this house down there? I just couldn't visualize my doing that, but I could visualize you're out there with your kids. You're not in an intimidating manner, and you're just, you know anything that's going on in the neighborhood. I could see how that would work.
Yeah. And a Saturday morning is important too, because people are out cutting their grass, or in the wintertime, they're doing something on the, you know, blowing snow if you're in the north somewhere. But that's the important part, is you want to go, and people are just naturally out in their yard. And I'm not a naturally like outgoing person, especially when I first started this business. And it was sort of a growth challenge for me to do that, to go out and just talk to people. And so I think this might like disqualify some people from real estate, and it might draw other people to it. But the fact is that if you're wanting just to kind of passively buy index funds and press a button on a computer, you know, I love that stuff. I love Jim Collins' stock series as much as anybody. But real estate, both the benefit and the drawback of real estate is that you have more control over it. It goes through you. And so the positive of that is if you want to have some control over how fast you get to financial independence, all you need to do is try to learn faster, do more, talk to more people. But the downside of that is you have to do it. You have to be the one who does that. And one of those skills is actually just having conversations with people. And if that is totally outside your comfort zone, you don't have to do that. I'm just telling you that's the best way to do it. You can also hire an agent to do that. And so if I hired a buyer's agent, I would say, I want you, buyer's agent, to go out and walk the neighborhood, you know, on Saturday morning and see what's out there. And there'll be open houses. There'll be stuff going on. But I think that's the thing a lot of people miss. It was so easy in 2009 and 10 buying properties because there was a lot of foreclosures. Banks were selling houses. But that was the anomaly. That was the weird time for those 2 or 3 years where it was just easy pickings buying real estate. What it is now, where it's more competitive and it's kind of hard. People say, gosh, it's hard to find a deal. Well, these people are just looking on the MLS on the listed properties, and there's nothing available listed that seems like a good deal. And so they say, oh, there's nothing available. Well, I promise you, because the 15 years I've been doing it and the 30 or 40 years of history I've been reading about real estate and people investing, nobody's willing to go out and do these extra steps of walking a neighborhood, of talking to people. You know, there's some more advanced strategies, sending letters out, doing some extra steps. You know, if you're willing to do it, put a little bit more effort in up front, there's a lot of benefit to doing that.
Yeah. And Chad, I know in my little town, just driving the 1 mile to our elementary school, when I actually look around, there are a couple of houses that just kind of look like nobody's living there, and you just never know, right? To your point about writing letters or something like that. Like if I actually took the initiative and said, oh, here's this house that looks pretty nice. It looks like it has good bones, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's in great part of town, but it looks like it's being neglected or abandoned. Mm-hmm. What if that's a house that someone's looking to get rid of, or maybe it was in a will, got passed on, and they just want to get rid of it, but they don't know how? Like that's something where I would not have even thought, honestly, to write that letter or even know how to go about contacting someone. But I suspect if we talked outside of this, or if you had it on your website of how to physically contact those people, how to find that information, and you know, that's outside the scope of this, but I think it's important for people to start just thinking differently, like you're describing. And so I get walking around. And to me, that's a really cool way to look at this. But the accountant side of me says, okay, at what point does running the numbers come into it? Because my fear would be, all right, I'm going to schlep my kids out for 5 hours on a Saturday, and we're going to walk through some communities that just financially don't make sense. Either the real estate is too expensive, or the rents aren't good, you know, whatever it may be. So that's my concern. So we'd love to hear, like, when does that come into play?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And so when you're a real estate investor, you're like a walking dichotomy. You've got the emotional kind of appeal neighborhood side of you. And then you could call that your right brain. And then you've got the numbers crunching, you know, lizard brain. It's all about the numbers. You know, that's it. And so you got to do both all the time. And so you kind of go back and forth. And so what I would do before I went out and walked neighborhoods, I would put together a little profile of what I think a good deal is from the very beginning. And so that, and we could talk about the numbers real briefly because, you know, sometimes numbers are easier on paper and putting them out. But the bottom line in real estate, and particularly with house hacking, the most important number you want to look at is how much rent you have left over every single month after paying all your expenses. And then you compare that to what the price is. And so for the stock people out there, that's like your PE ratio. That's like your earnings to price ratio. And what ratio of earnings am I going to get from a piece of real estate compared to what I'm going to have to pay as a price for that real estate?
Do you want to use this as an opportunity to walk us through your first example?
Perfect. Yeah, that'd be great. So you're talking about my house hacking article. I gave an example of like my house, right, of the one I moved into. And the number, and I'll give these numbers just because some people who are going to be listening to this in Canada or Great Britain, because I've gotten emails from people there say, that's ridiculous. I've never heard of numbers like that. You know, that was probably like 50 years ago. And then people in California say the same thing. And then people in, you know, I don't know, Indiana are saying that's exactly the numbers I'm looking at. So, you know, you got to kind of use this as all relative depending on where you are. But the concept of house hacking works anywhere because it reduces whatever your payment is on a house or a duplex. It's going to reduce that by getting rent from the other side. It's just going to be a matter of whether your rent's going to pay for all of your mortgage payment or pay for half of it or a quarter of it. And either one is still a win. Like my numbers, for example, when I'm shopping a neighborhood, when I first started looking, I would do something called, and this is a very simple rule that got, everybody can kind of take with them when they're looking. I was always looking for something called the 1% rule. All right. And so the 1% rule means that if you look at the monthly rent of a property, and let's use simple round numbers, if you ask the real estate agent or property manager, or you looked on Zillow, and the average rent for an apartment around your area is $1,000 per month. Let's just use that number. If that's the case, then you probably a decent deal or a good deal in house hacking would be that you could buy that one unit for $100,000. So if it was a duplex, you would have two units renting, so that'd be $2,000. So like a rough number of what would be a good deal would be $200,000 all in for buying that property. And so you could go into like the real nitty gritty numbers and put it in a spreadsheet and go through all your expenses and figure out why that's the case. But that typically produces a decent cash flow, particularly for a house hack. If you can borrow a 30-year mortgage at 4% or 3.5% and live in one side and rent the other side out, you're going to be in pretty good shape if you can kind of stick to that kind of number. And so that's just what that's called, the 1% rule. It's a rule of thumb. There's going to be some areas, you know, my town, that it's still a challenge to find a 1%, particularly with the like nicer neighborhoods. But if you're in the higher price, you know, if you're in California, if you're in some of the higher price areas, that's going to be really, really difficult because the prices tend to become detached from the rental rates as you get into higher and higher price areas. But it's still a goal. It's a good goal. And in my case, with the property I bought, my first quadruplex, the numbers were much better than that. They were really good. I bought the property for $70,000 and we put $45,000 into it in repairs and holding costs. So it was at $115,000. And then I refinanced it. So I had a little bit more in it. So I kind of rounded up to $120,000 was my total kind of all-in investment in a quadruplex. And so that I like to divide it out by unit. So, you know, for four units, that's $30,000 per unit. And when I first moved into that property, the rents for each one of those units was $400.
Nice. So way above the, 1.33%, I guess, in that case, right?
Yeah. If I would have been following the 1% rule, my rent was $300 per unit. I would have tried to have, $440,000 per unit or $160,000 in that property, I think I would have been in good shape. But it was a really good deal, and I ended up having $120,000 in the property instead. So if you look at the article and you look at all the numbers on what kind of cash flow I had, the bottom line was I lived in one unit. I rented the other three units out. So I had $1,200 coming in every month, And my mortgage payment, including taxes and insurance, was just under, I think it was $1,086 per month or so. So I had $1,100 or $1,200 coming in, $1,086 going out. I think that was my all in with all my costs. And I'm not looking at my numbers right now on the article, but the bottom line was when I paid all my expenses, including some maintenance and other things, I had about $100 a month positive in the bank on that deal. So it was a very, very good deal. I called it, like in a baseball analogy, that was a triple. You know, it was off the wall triple standing up. Not all good deals are that good, but you know, it demonstrated the concept of how powerful it could be if you can live in a house, live for free, actually live positive every month. And then the beautiful thing for me was, you know, my wife and I moved in. We got married actually soon after I bought that. We lived there for 2 or 3 years, decided we want to start a family. But that gave us an awesome start to our, you know, to our marriage financially. We didn't have a lot of costs going out. We had two incomes coming in. And so we were really able to rack up some big time savings during those times before we started kind of moving on to other things.
I love this. I think especially what's powerful about this is just potentially something that everybody that's in their early 20s and they're getting that first home, this could be something that just, this is what you do if you're in a certain community. This is the norm because it just totally makes sense. And you're just leaving hundreds of thousands of dollars on the table by not doing this. And the math that you just shared on how you kind of approached it, and is it a good deal? Is it not a good deal? It's pretty simple math. I mean, there wasn't anything really magical or complicated about what you just said. I mean, you might need to practice it a couple times, put it on an Excel sheet, but you could very easily go on to Zillow and filter for some apartments that are selling or some four quadruplexes, triplexes, duplexes, and run those numbers very, very quickly and get a feel for what it is that you just described.
Exactly. I'm not bad in math, but I'm certainly not. There's some people in the fire community who like run circles around me with spreadsheets, you know, and I love that. I love hanging out with like smart people and mad scientists and these guys who do all that stuff. But one of the cool things about real estate, in addition to the fact that you have the more control over it, is that the math for your deals is super simple. I mean, it's addition and subtraction and maybe some basic algebra. You know, that's about as far as you get. There's no calculus. There's no, you know, gradual curves of lines and things like that. I mean, you're super simple math that it's more about identifying what I said earlier, you know, find the romantic neighborhoods, find the places where they're attractive, and then go back to Brad's point, try to marry that good neighborhood with some reasonable numbers. That's the challenge. You know, that's the thing that makes it not super easy. You're going to have to do some hunting. It's not going to just fall in your lap. You've got to actually go out there and hunt a little bit, but it's worth it in the end.
Well, three things come to mind. One is it is that exact process. It's that hunting that's going to allow you to find the inefficiencies in the market, as opposed to the stock market, the index fund. It's going to correct itself. Now, we accept the fact and we appreciate the fact and we benefit from the fact that over time, it almost always goes up with index funds. But with real estate, it does not correct itself as quickly. And you're often able to take advantage of those inefficiencies to your benefit if you're willing to get out there and look for it.
Exactly. And there's one other benefit that I should have mentioned early on about house hacking is that real estate, you know, you have the sticks and the bricks, the real estate, which is pretty much what we've been talking about so far, and the income that it produces. But the other really huge thing is that you can use some safe leverage to go along with that real estate. And so there's a whole gamut of people who kind of are willing to either take a lot of risk with leverage and very little risk. And I know some real estate investors who use zero debt at all on any of their real estate from the very beginning. You know, that's the Dave Ramsey model. Mm-hmm. I know you guys talk about Dave Ramsey a lot. So any variation in between there is fine.
Yeah.
But you're really, I personally think it's very reasonable, particularly when you're getting an owner-occupied mortgage like you do with a house hack. If you can get a 30-year fixed or a 20-year fixed at 3 or 4%, and you can live in the property and you can cover almost all of your mortgage or more with that rent, that leverage is what really catapults your financial your growth as well. Because you can, if you read the article that I talked about, it went from a double to a triple, maybe even a home run because of the financing I was able to get on the property. Because I actually started off by going to a local bank, and the local bank loaned me 80% of the purchase price. And I used private investors to help me come up with the cash for the fixing up, the repairs and all that. And so, but then I had a bunch of cash and I owed some private lenders some money at higher interest rates. And so what I did 6 months after moving into the property was, this is my residence. So I was able to go out and refinance it and get a very solid loan, you know, long-term loan, fixed interest rate. But the really sweet thing for me was that the property had appreciated up to about $155,000. And so I was able to refinance and pull out 100% of the money that I had in it. So like I borrowed $120,000 and essentially had, you know, had no money in the deal, and it still cash flowed positive.
Yeah.
And so I was able to take money that I had and go do another deal or invest in the stock market or whatever else you want to do.
Yeah. I always want to come back essentially with highlighter when you say something that's just you, the audience, y'all need to latch onto this point. So when he's doing this, what he's just describing, he was creative. He got in there and he used a process that he can replicate over and over again. And he did have to get the money together to get the property. But now, however many months later, he has pulled all of that out. So he has been able, he just, by doing this one thing, he's essentially created a way to generate $1,000 a month in income for perpetuity. And he has nothing invested in the deal anymore. And now he can take his income that he may have plus the extra $1,000 a month of rent, and he can go and do this again.
Yeah.
That's incredible. The other point I wanted to make sure that we didn't pass by is you specifically said duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. And I know the answer, but I want to just put it out there. Why not a fiveplex?
Yeah. So in this has to do with financing. And so financing is everything in real estate. But when you move into a one unit, two unit, three unit, or four unit, the financing is basically the options are much broader to get a loan. And that's pretty much because if you're in the United States, the almost every mortgage out there is guaranteed, or at least implied, you know, will be guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those are the big, you know, quasi-governmental entities that buy a lot of the mortgages and guarantee a lot of the mortgages in the market. And for, you know, they have determined that owner-occupant residential mortgages are 1 to 4 unit buildings. That's it. So when you get above 4 units, your 30-year fixed 4% financing disappears. It's just a whole other world. You're getting into the commercial lending world, and there are some decent options out there, but by and large, the best mortgages you're ever going to get are the ones on those 1 to 4 units. And so that's why you want to stick with those. You want to stick with something in that realm because the financing is so much better.
Hey, Chad, just jumping on the financing for a second, which is you're doing this house hack and you're living in one of them, right? And you got the owner-occupant financing, so a little more favorable than not. Now, let's say you move out at some point in the future. What happens to your mortgage then? I mean, do you need to like literally, this might be the most elementary question, but it's a question probably people out there have, which is, do you call up your mortgage company and say, hey, I'm not living in there anymore. Give me, you know, half a point higher in interest rate. You know, does anything happen like that? Or
no, it's a good question, and that does come up a lot. And the answer is no. That you're it's perfectly reasonable that your life changes, and you know 2-3 years later you decide to move on, and there's no you don't have to pay the loan off. The only thing, if you read the mortgage documents, it says it stipulates that you have to be an owner occupant when you borrow the money, and you have to have the intention of living there. And so in my case, I like to live there, and I've stayed 2 or 3 years, and that's my residence. But after that, one of the most beautiful things about house hacking is you have this long-term fixed mortgage, and if you bought it in the right neighborhood, going back to the good romantic neighborhood, it's probably over the next 10 to 15, 20 years going to go up in value. The rents are going to increase, the prices are going to increase. And so you have this fixed payment. Your biggest expense is your interest mortgage payment, and that's fixed for the next 20, 30 years. And you have rent that's going up over time. That's the most beautiful financial arrangement in all of the investment world, because you have a fixed cost and rising income over time. And that's the kind of definition of a good rental property. And so that's a really good question, because that's the next step of house hacking. If you want to take it, is that like I did 3 years later, I moved out, moved into a house. And what do we do after that? We rented out the unit that we used to live in. And now it's producing, you know, another $400 a month in cash flow. And so it's a $500 positive cash flow rental instead of a $100 positive cash flow rental. And I'll have to say, you know, my story, the house hack was, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And the rent that I get now, it used to be $400, is now up to $525 per unit. So wow, that's cool. That's the story.
Do you take that money and use it to purchase other investments, or do you pay down the mortgage? I mean, I know it's personal preference, obviously, but I'm just curious.
Sure. No, that's a good question. So I write a lot about strategy in real estate and how do you use that extra cash flow that you produce. And it depends on your plan. For us, we used it to grow a little bit more. We'd save up and buy another property. But my favorite plan in all of real estate for financial independence is to do something, y'all are familiar with this, is just to do a real estate rental debt snowball. Nice. So instead of just keeping leverage perpetually, which some real estate investors do, is to, you know, buy two or three properties, get them producing a couple $1,000 a month in cash flow or whatever the number is. And then you make the minimum mortgage payment on all those properties, but then you take that extra $2,000 a month in cash flow plus maybe another $3,000 or $4,000 per month that you can set aside and save from your high savings rate. And you start attacking one rental property at a time. And you can get, I've written articles on this too, but you can get one property paid off in, you know, 4 or 5 years, maybe sooner. And then now you freed up your mortgage payment from that one. Then you attack the next one. And the long and short of it is in 12 to 15 years, you could have a nice portfolio of free and clear properties that produce $5,000-$6,000 a month, and you're set. That's your income that you live up on and kind of move on for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that is really awesome. I love that. And yeah, that kind of ties into another article you wrote about how many rental properties do you need to retire? And maybe we'll talk about that either later in this podcast or in a future one. But I just kind of wanted to double back real quick. So we look for actionable tips for our audience, and you've given a ton already. But I want to put myself in the brain of a 23-year-old kid who just graduated college, like you, obviously, with this first house hack. Let's say I don't have any money saved up. You described getting the $45,000 in cash from a private real estate investor. How does someone get into that community? How does someone get access to that? You know, if I was just, and I hate to call them kids, but if I was a 23-year-old kid who had no money and had no contacts, how do I even start with this?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge to a lot of people when they're thinking about the money. Like, where does the money come from? It's kind of hard to get your head around it. And there's a couple ways, particularly with the house hack. Let's just kind of keep it on that idea. And, you know, I was a very creative investor, and a lot of the times I had to do that because you have to remember, I had zero like guaranteed income coming in from my business. I was an entrepreneur. I had good credit, but I was not your typical, I have a salary, I've got, you know, W-2 income coming in, I can, and that's the easiest borrower in the world. Like, I was not an easy borrower. In some cases, like my having to go out and get private money was maybe not the best example. Like, what I would recommend first, and if you look at the house hacking article, I give some links to how, like, to some actual programs that do this. So there's some remodeling loan programs out there. Like, there's one example right now called FHA, I think it's a 203K loan. And so FHA is a government-sponsored, federally subsidized loan, but they have a program where you can buy a house hack, you can buy a duplex, you can move in, and you can give the lender like the specs for what repairs you want to do. So let's say you wanted to like remodel the kitchens, and you wanted to change the roof out, and you want to put heat and air units in. You know, let's say that costs $20,000 to do all the work you wanted to do. You could apply as part of your loan to do that $20,000 in work. And they would loan you the money as part of your FHA loan to do that work. And I think I think FHA has a 3.5% down payment. And so that's one of the reasons FHA is just like, it's got some downsides. Like, there's a higher mortgage insurance and there's some fees up front. But if you can do that, or there's another program called, there's a Fannie Mae remodeling loan, you know, I would check those out first, because you can go to your mortgage broker and find an investment kind of oriented mortgage broker and say, I'd like to buy this kind of property. I'd like to do some remodeling typically. You know, can you help me get qualified for an FHA 203K loan or a Fannie Mae? I think it's a Home Style, or I forget the exact name of that mortgage because I haven't used it lately. But one of those two options, Brad, would be probably where I would point people at first. You know, but down the road, you know, there's a whole kind of art and science to getting money from individuals as well. And that's something I've had to work really hard on early on. And it really comes down to, if you just boil it down, is to relationships. It's just being a trustworthy person, building, not trying to go for the sale right away, but just talking to people about all the time about your real estate investing, telling people that you invest in real estate, and talking about the numbers. You know, like, I go around, my original private lender was a professor at Clemson, who was my business professor. I took some business classes after I graduated just for the fun of it, because I thought I would go into that. And so I used to just tell him, hey, I'm finding deals like this My only problem is I have $1,000 in the bank. I can't buy it. You know, what do you think? And he would say, all right, you find the deal. I'll put up some money. Don't worry about that. And that's if you get relationships with other investors, particularly like the more experienced investors. My private lender used to call me that I was the young pup and he was the old lion. And so like you need to find some old lions who,
that's awesome,
who are kind of, you know, they really don't want to go out and do all the work that you're doing. You're the young, energetic puppy who's kind of like running around tripping on your ears. But you do have a lot of energy and that's something going for you. And so if you're a young pup, find an old lion or two, find these people who have some money and they're out there that you just have to, it's not going to be an overnight kind of thing. You got to talk to people, tell them what you're doing and say, I need some money for my deals. Would you be interested in making a 6% return if you loan me the money to buy the house instead of putting it in somewhere else? And so like the end goal, I can make it really simple. This number is going to vary depending on what your particular goals are. But if you're listening to this show, I know you're the kind of people who are kind of tracking your finances and you're figuring out your budget. So I don't even have to go there. But you start off with, what's your number? You know, what kind of budget do you have that would be, if I was financially independent, this is the income that would be enough to cover my family's expenses so that I wouldn't have to work anymore. That's the starting point, just like it is with any other path to financial independence. And so let's just use the number $5,000 a month, because that's a nice, easy round number.
Yeah.
And let's say that the goal then is to get enough real estate that pays you $5,000 a month and does it in a very low risk, passive, low time investment way. That's the goal. It's not only the money, it's also the hassle and the time. And my favorite way to do that is just to say, all right, what if I owned a certain number of properties free and clear of debt that had zero mortgage payment? Then all I'd have to do is pay my taxes and my insurance and my other kind of operating expenses. And whatever's left over goes into my pocket. And that's what I live off of. And so really the math is super simple. It's just a matter of saying, all right, let's say in my town, five properties when they're paid off, so five duplexes would be enough to pay me that $5,000 a month. Therefore, my goal is to acquire five rental properties and then do some kind of plan. And you could buy more rental properties and then try to kind of get back down to that five. Or you could just say, I'm just going to buy five rental properties. So one property per year for the next 5 years. And then I'm going to concentrate on saving as much money as I can, both from the cash flow and the rental properties, and then extra savings I can get from work, from a side hustle, whatever you do. I'm just going to attack those debts like crazy for the next 10 years or however much long it takes. And I'm going to get them paid off. And then that's it. The math is super simple.
Yeah, no, it really is. And if you just take everything you just said and distill it down, you're essentially saying, hey, you're 20 years old. Be creative, learn how to do the math, learn how to bird dog, find some deals, find a deal, decide to do a house hack, live in one side and, you know, rent out the other two or three or four, you know, three sides. And then now you're essentially, you don't have housing income. Potentially you're even making money with that $1,000 a month in profit. I mean, you combine that with almost any job and now you're able to set aside money for your down payment. You're living for free. You don't have that living expense. And then you do the math that you just talked about with how many rental units do I need to retire? You just basically said, hey, five might be the number for you. It might be that simple. If they're bringing in $5,000 a month, focus on building those out one per year for the next 5 or 6 years. And then essentially just ride that out for the next 10 years. And congratulations, you're financially independent.
That's pretty much it.
Sounds so simple. Why isn't everybody doing this, right?
the plan really is simple. The execution, like we talked about, Brad asked a good question earlier. How do you find these deals? How do you put it together? That's kind of where the rubber meets the road. But I think what I would leave people with is, if this kind of thing appeals to you, if this, the idea of buying real estate, of living in it, it really is a game. Like I've always, my business partner and I have looked at it like a game from the very beginning. I'm a sports guy. I like games. I like to keep score. And so just if you look at it like that and you say for 5 to 10 years of my life, I'm going to play this game and I'm either going to do it as my kind of like my one vehicle for achieving financial independence, or I'm going to do it parallel to like my other one. I might do this one plus, my Jim Collins passive index stock investing at the same time and then commit to it. And that's kind of the way we've looked at it. We've had a lot of fun with it. There's been some challenging times, but instead of looking at, oh, man, I'm going to have to do a lot of work in real estate, I'm going to play this game for the next 5 to 10 years. And man, it's going to be awesome in the end because I'm going to have this income coming in and I'm going to have a lot of other cool stuff that I'm going to do along the way.
Hey, Chad, if you don't mind me asking, and please feel free if this is too personal, but what percentage of your net worth is in real estate? And do you follow the passive income or passive index investing strategy in your own life? You know, I guess if you wouldn't mind, just give us some sense of what you do personally.
Yeah, I don't mind. I'm definitely very heavy in real estate. And I would equate this to, I'm basically an entrepreneur. Like I've used my entire kind of business for the last 15 years has been real estate. And so just like, anybody else who starts a business, that's kind of that's a big chunk of your net worth. That's what kind of gets you there. But at the same time, we've had retirement accounts. And so I think percentage wise, I looked at it, I did the personal capital and kind of keep track of that kind of stuff. And I think it's about 15% for me is stock kind of funds at the moment. I like that number to be big there. Maybe that's a third long run. Maybe I'm a third in stock businesses because I really do think that's an awesome long-term kind of diversification for me. But for me, it was all about getting to the finish line. And I'm more like Warren Buffett and value investing kind of philosophy in terms of real estate, because I think that kind of philosophy works in real estate where you find, instead of trying to like diversify over the entire world, I'm just putting all my eggs in a couple baskets that I know are really solid. And I'm watching those baskets really closely. That's my real estate philosophy. But long run, I'm a diversification. I see the value of diversification. And so, after you achieve a certain plateau with a certain amount of net worth, a certain amount of income, I definitely think it's wise to branch out. So for me, the diversification for me has been have a lot of cash and a lot of real estate. I also do some notes, like note investing. Instead of just having rental properties, I also loan, have some financing where I've financed houses to other people. And so that's a nice kind of variation on real estate that also produces some income as well.
Yeah, that's very cool. I think from reading your articles, I guess you and your business partner have somewhere in the vicinity of 90 properties. Is that approximately correct?
Yeah, and that's too many. We had 60 before last year. We just bought 30 units the last year just because we couldn't pass them up. They were good deals. And so I think in the next year or two, that'll get reduced back down. I think some of those units that we bought are development projects where we're turning the project around. We're adding some value to some apartments. We're raising the rents. There's some undeveloped land attached to it that we could sell off. And there's a bunch of developers coming in from around the country in our town and buying up properties. So I expect that 90 number will go down because that's not our fun, relaxing long-term number. But we're in the business, so we like to. I'm kind of hesitant to say that number sometimes because then people think, "Wow, that's crazy. That's not passive." And I think for most people, you get 5 or 10 properties, or even 1 or 2 properties. You take care of those. You make sure they're good deals. That can be a very, very solid real estate portfolio for a lot of people.
Yeah, and that kind of answers what, my follow-up question, which is going to be, is this ultimately a let's get it as big as we possibly can empire? Does 90 turn into 900 into 9,000 someday? Or is it, are you guys playing the free and clear plan, which is let's have 90 or 60 or whatever you wind up with and then pay them off with that extra cash flow? Like, is that something you and your business partner have sat down and discussed that thoroughly? Or is it just, oh, we see a deal, it's too good to pass up? Is it some combination of that? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it's probably more the latter. So I actually have some really good debates and articles I write on biggerpockets.com, which is like the big real estate, website, where I'm a keep it simple, pay them off, don't try to get big kind of investor. That's always my article, my debate, part of the debate. Whereas like it seems like kind of the common thinking for a lot of kind of go-getter real estate people is, you get one property, you get a duplex, you sell it, you use your equity to go into a 10-plex, then you sell the 10-plex and you get into a 50-plex. You just keep moving up until you own the Empire State Building in New York City. That's kind of the normal route. I definitely push back against that. And I think that's more my kind of FIRE community, early retirement community roots. That's what I identify is that, at some point enough's enough. What do you really need to do with, gosh, I got $100,000 a month coming in. This is great. I can't even fathom the reason that I would want to get that big. And I think that's it's just not necessary. particularly because it goes back to what are you, you know, why are you doing this in the first place? And for me, my wife's really always a good governor for me is like, you know, what do we want to do? Like, what do we want to do with our life? We want to travel. We want to go learn Spanish. We want to do some of these things. And I love real estate investing. I'm a nerd. You know, I like to do this stuff and I love to teach it.
We're with you, brother. We're with you.
At the same time though, there's these other, you gotta find these other things in life, and having 1,000 units is ridiculous if you want to try to go be simple, live your life and kind of do some other stuff. And so, you know, we're not perfect, and I'm constantly looking for that kind of balance point. I think 90 is over our balance point, but at the same time, it's just I'm opportunistic, and we hired a third party property manager to manage those extra units. Like, we didn't try to do that ourselves. And so I'm opportunistic, but at the same time, I think the long run is keep it as simple as you need it to be, whether that's 2 houses, whether that's 50 houses, and keep it as simple as it needs to be to meet whatever that financial independence goal, that why behind all your money is, and whatever that number is for you. Don't let other people sway you from saying you got to get bigger than that.
That's so powerful. I love how rooted you are in the FIRE community. I find that I relate to you, you know, and what you're saying very much. And I think for us, the common theme that you hear is at some point you just have enough. And isn't that in some way rewarding, that the goal is not to be the person with the most money? That's not the conversations that are being had in the FIRE community. That's not what we're talking about. Our goal is not money. Our goal is freedom and flexibility and spending time with family and developing relationships and real estate and investing and all these life hacks that we're unrolling. They're tools not to help earn you money, although that may be a sign that you're hitting your ultimate goal, but we're trying to help you buy your freedom. And I was going to try and re-say everything you said, but you said it so well that you summed it up perfectly. And I think that's encouraging for someone that may not think to themselves, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to have 90 units. Well, he's telling you, you don't have to. You don't need that. 5 is a simple number.
Absolutely. I think you're going to be happy. If you look at your happiness quotient, I mean, for most people, that 1 to 5 range is perfectly fine. Yeah, I encourage everybody to run home. And after you listen, just run some numbers. You know, just do some numbers, do some simple math and say, all right, a rental property in my area rents for $1,000 or $1,200. And let's say I netted half of that. You know, $600 a month was what I came out with after it was all said and done per house. Is that enough? Is $600 a month good for me? Or do I need 3 properties? Do I need to be at $1,800 a month? Or, you know, just run that simple math and make it work for you. That's the message.
You know what's great about this, Chad? When Brad and I decided that we were going to start doing this podcast, we thought to ourselves, you know what? We're just going to do it. It's going to be short 20-minute conversations, and we're just going to unleash them in piecemeal. But then we actually started doing it, and how much we actually love this content and just discussing these ideas. We can't do it. And so that's why you guys are listening to a podcast that's over an hour long. How can I let Coach Carson go without digging into some of this information? It would be criminal. So I hope that our audience appreciates the fact that these are an hour, because we're not wasting your time. We're trying to give you, just hit you with actionable tip after actionable tip. And so, I mean, Chad, this has just been awesome.
You guys are doing a great job of pulling it out. I appreciate you.
All right. So it is time. Lucky you, you are going to be our guest on the hot seat today. So don't be scared, but the epic music intro is coming. Wait for it.
All right.
And enjoy it without laughing.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Chad, number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Yeah, so I listen to a guy or read a blog named Brian Johnson. It's called, and his website is called optimize.me. And it's actually not a personal finance blog, but it's like a personal development. And the thing I love about it is it's kind of like, you know, everybody knows about Cliff Notes. They're the book summaries for the books you had in high school, like the literature book that you didn't really want to read the whole thing, but you had to for a test, and you would read the Cliff Notes. Well, he's done like 400 Cliff Notes on everything from like Marcus Aurelius, you know, the Stoic philosophy, all the way up to positive psychology and modern kind of thinking on cognitive therapy. And so if you're into that kind of stuff, I think people in personal finance are into kind of improving yourself and becoming better. He's just a really, I've been following him probably 10 years. And he's just a cool guy, grounded, down to earth, that writes some cool stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've never heard. You know what I love about this is I always love being pointed to someone else that I didn't know about, because you just don't find this stuff. Google, even though it's amazing, unless you have something to look for, you're not going to stumble into it. So we'll link to this guy in the show notes so we can go check it out.
Definitely. He's good.
All right. Question number two, Chad, your favorite article of all time.
So I listened to a couple of your other podcasts, and I know there's kind of the common answers, and some of my initial answers, I was thinking Mr. Money Mustache, some of that stuff I love. But actually, there's a friend of mine, a blogger friend, who writes a blog at eatthefinancialelephant.com. And Chris is his name. And he had this article that just totally resonated with me called Dirtbag Millionaires. And the concept was basically like he and his wife were outdoorsy people, and they loved to hike and climb mountains and do all that. And they had some friends who were like these dirtbags who like totally went into the outdoor life, and they lived on the edge, lived for the moment. They lived in the back of cars and, you know, just dirt, you know, sleeping on people's couches, mm-hmm. but they lived for like the passion of just doing what they wanted to do. And those are the dirt bags that everybody kind of admired, but then you're like, well, you know, they're one illness away from disaster. And, you know, so you couldn't like bring yourself to do that, but you love that lifestyle. And at the same time, he worked with a lot of people who made a ton of money and were professionals and bought the nice cars and, you know, lived that kind of higher money lifestyle, and he couldn't really resonate with that either. But he loved the idea of financial independence while kind of being wealthy, but living like a dirtbag and doing what you love. And so I totally resonated with that. Oh, I thought that was such a cool
philosophy. Super cool.
I'll give you guys the link so you can link to it later.
Nice. All right, number three, your favorite life hack.
So I'm going totally low tech on this one. My life hack is actually sitting down every week and also every year, and just with a pen and a paper and planning. So planning out my week, planning out my day, planning out my year, and whether that's 5 minutes or an hour or whatever, just actually like thinking about like for the next week, what are the I think the analogy that I always resonated with, like what are the big rocks and the little rocks? Like if you're going to fill your week up, like it's kind of like a jar of time. If you're going to fill it up, if you put all the little rocks in first, all the things that are not that important, then you're just going to fill it up with trivial stuff, as opposed to actually like scheduling the things that are important to you, but that aren't necessarily urgent, like exercise, like eating well, like working on your, you know, walking a neighborhood to find your house hack or whatever it might be. And actually like scheduling, putting that in a schedule, whether that's a paper schedule, your Google Calendar. I've found for the last 15 years, basically, that practice has just been awesome in terms of effectiveness and getting things out of your week, out of your year. It's just kind of hard to beat that kind of low tech planning hack.
No, that's great. I love low tech hacks. Now, do you just do this on scratch paper, or do you put it on a special like type binder that you reserve for just this type of thing?
I've got a little like a 3-ring binder, like the little day planner kind of binder with a leather binder that I carry around. And that was like the one thing is I could leave a lot of stuff behind when I left for Ecuador, but like I could not leave that binder behind. That thing was like, it has a calendar and it has some little sheets of, you know, kind of notes and thinking in there and that sort of thing.
Not to go back to the interview, but I got to say, when you're talking about all the things that you would have to unhinge your life from to do the move that y'all did, I was feeling a little of the pain along with you. Cause I can, yeah, you get rooted in your community for sure.
It's tough. It was a tough, but awesome experience.
Yeah. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Okay. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
Yeah. Mine was related to my business. So, you know, we got through it, but in 2007 was, if everybody kind of knows the timeline of the Great Recession in the US, that was sort of right before things started going down. Like the end of 2007, early 2008 was things started going crazy. And we actually had our biggest volume year ever. We had 50 closings that year where we bought 50 properties. And so a bunch of those we sold, some of them we kept, but the mistake was that we kind of bought into other people's goals. We were going to seminars and we were saying, wow, you can do that. And I kind of got caught up in that. I got really good at buying properties, but I got sloppy. And so I'd say like out of the 50 properties we bought, 3/4 of them were really good deals. We made money on them, or they're good long-term rentals. But that other 25%, like we've been dealing with those for the last 10 years. You know, it's kind of like bubble gum that gets stuck on the bottom of your shoe. Like it just takes forever to like pull that stuff off the bottom of your shoe, and it's annoying and sticky and doesn't help you. I think we would have been a lot better off. I think I've learned a lot of lessons. I'm kind of one of those people that has to get smacked upside the head before I learn a lesson. So I learned a lot of lessons about that, but and that goes back to the simplicity and the enough. Like, you really need that many deals, or do you just need to be have enough that you're effective and you get you keep moving forward? That was our big lesson.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, Chad, last one, number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
I would tell myself to do exactly what I did.
Nice.
I just don't have,
that's awesome.
I don't have any, like particularly with being an entrepreneur. I don't, you know, this isn't for everybody. Like, the entrepreneurial lifestyle of the, you know, not having any guarantees. Every day you wake up, you're unemployed and you got to go out and make it happen is not for everybody. But I know, like, looking in the mirror, that is just, it's been awesome. It's like a, you know, as somebody who likes to play sports and challenges and entrepreneurship, it was just a lot of fun. And it was something that I really got to live a lot of the benefits of financial independence before I even got there. It's, you know, I used to play when I first 3 or 4 years in business, my business partner and I love pickup basketball. And we would go for 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day and play pickup basketball with all the coaches at Clemson. And we play in the stadium where all the basketball team plays, the big arena. And we would just like hack it, you know, just have these awesome pickup basketball games for hours, and you'd be sweaty. And like every, you're like, I was always thinking to myself, if I had some coat and tie living in New York City, I would never be doing this. And yet I was doing that. And then I'd go take a shower and go try to buy a house after that. And I probably worked until 10 or 11 at night anyway. But the thing was, it was just so, whether you're doing a side hustle or whether you're doing it full time, entrepreneurship is just such a fun, kind of challenging thing that I would tell my younger self to do it all over again.
Yeah. Two things come to mind. One is that, to me anyways, I don't think of you as a guru. And I know in general, I kind of have the same philosophy on that as the people from Bigger Pockets do. It kind of makes me cringe. I don't like the idea of it. I want someone that I can relate to, that I can see their decision tree. I don't all feel like they're always trying to upsell me into something. I think that that's the way that you present yourself. I think that's the way that's a reason that I relate to all the articles you write and the content you write. I mean, it's just, I understand your decision tree. And I love the fact that you don't look back at your process with regrets, that you can tell your younger self, just do this, man, just do this. It works. Yeah. So I really think that's cool. This is a little bonus question. It's super short. Brad and I want to know, we're asking all of our guests going forward in the FIRE community, when we make purchases, we always look at the value proposition, but we do purchase stuff, and you may be frugal with 90% of your life. We want to know, what's the best thing that you purchased on Amazon last year?
I'm a book nerd. So I think I purchased a book, Thinking Fast and Slow by, he's a psychologist named Daniel Kahneman, I think, or Kahneman. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Kahneman.
Yeah, it was a really, I brought that book with me. I had to that was one of the toughest decisions I had coming to Ecuador. I was like, man, what books am I going to leave behind? So Amazon books. If I'm up on the internet at 11 o'clock at night, I'll wake up like a week later and say, did I order a book? You know, here, a book came in the mail. What is this? So, that's awesome. That's like my splurge, you know?
That's awesome. All right. Well, this has just been absolutely fantastic. Brad, I can't believe just how much great content he was able to unpack. He's already done two absolutely amazing, you know, podcasts and articles over at Mad Scientist, but I got stuff out of this that I didn't get over there. And I mean, do you have any final thoughts on this?
This was incredible. Chad just really brought it and just gave us a lot of actionable information. And, you know, that's what Chooseify is all about. And yeah, we can't thank Chad enough for being on.
It just, to me, it makes sense, you know. We've been basically unpacking these different life hacks that you can start to implement. You know, we've talked about travel hacking, how to travel the world for free. We've talked a little bit about college hacking, how to optimize that. We've talked about food, how to decrease your food budget. We've talked about fitness, how to do fitness in just a way that makes sense. It's just a little bit smarter, you know, and as we always say, you don't have to do everything perfect and you don't have to do everything that we're doing, but if you can just, you know, lock up 1, 2, 3, if you can just lock up a few of these life hacks, you are going to retire decades in front of your peers. And I think what's super powerful, but what we're saying today and what we said already twice, and I just want to reiterate it, the ultimate goal for the FIRE community is not money. It's freedom. It's flexibility. It's spending time with those that you care about. And these are the tools that you can implement every single time. So, we hope that you enjoyed this awesome podcast and join us next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.